Chapter 6. We wove in and out of the shadows and stuck to the narrower streets. It was obvious that the locals had found a way to navigate through the city while avoiding the worst of the dinos. It was probably just a bit of bad luck that had led to the earlier encounter. They seemed happy enough to have us since we had the rifles, the Glocks, the Webley, and a bottle of cheap wine that we decided to bring along for the promised meal. No one talked, and my own attempts to ask questions were ignored. About halfway down a dark alley, our little group suddenly stopped. It took me a moment to realize that among the array of back doors, garbage cans, and occasional garages, there was an actual business. It was hard to see much more than the heavy oak door and a mud-splattered window. I thought the place might be the local version of a bodega at first, given the fuzzy view of a rack of long-expired snack foods that I could see. But Roger knocked on the door, and a moment later, the old lock clunked, and the door creaked open. It was creepier than the castle, but the 7 people we'd just rescued from the ruins all stepped across the threshold without hesitation, and so we followed them inside.
"Ah, my friends!"
A male voice with a trace of an Indian accent greeted us.
"It's good to see that everyone made it."
"Only thanks to these good folks,"
Betty replied as she pointed to the 3 of us. It took my eyes a moment to adjust to the dim light, but I realized we were in a small room with a long bar on one side and a row of booths along the other. There was no room for tables in the place since the area between booths and bar had been filled with a pair of billiard tables. A well-used dartboard hung on the back wall, between a bathroom door and a swinging door that I assumed was the kitchen. It smelled like stale cigarettes and spilled beer, and something crunched underfoot as we walked across the floor. There were 3 other people already in the place beside the Indian man, gathered in one of the booths. A small collection of scraggly carrots and tomatoes was piled on the table in front of them, along with a half-empty bag of rice. The 3 people in the booth, 2 women in their 60s who looked similar enough to be sisters, and a man in his 30s, looked fearfully at us. I saw the man start to stand up when he spotted our guns.
"Don't panic, Teddy,"
Betty said.
"These 3 saved us. We had to run into the castle, and it turns out that they stayed there the night before."
"We are always happy to see more people," the Indian man proclaimed. "Especially when they come bearing a bottle of wine. Now, let's see what else we have, and I can start to work on our meals for the day."
The other people in our group set their bags on the snooker tables and started to empty the contents. It was a hodgepodge of food and included everything from cans of English peas to a 6 eggs to a package of Genoa salami.
"Farid's a genius with food,"
Betty said as the Indian looked over the supplies.
"You give me too much credit," the Indian man said modestly.
He was a few inches shorter than me and had a very round head. His black hair was just starting to thin, but his mustache was thick and dark as ink. His eyes, in contrast, were a very light shade of brown and were magnified by a pair of heavy lenses in a red plastic frame. "Do you own this place?" I asked.
"No," he said. "I'm just a cook."
"He used to work for one of the hotels in London,"
Betty supplied.
"My wife and I wanted a smaller town to raise our children," Farid sighed.
I glanced at Becca and Haywan, and I could tell they were having the same thoughts I was. There was no sign of Farid's wife or kids in the pub. While it was perfectly possible they were safely tucked away in an apartment upstairs, the pat on the arm from Betty and the sad sigh from Roger seemed to suggest otherwise.
"You'll see them soon," Roger declared.
"Of course you will,"
one of the 60-somethings from the booth called out.
"I hope so," Farid replied. "It's been days since I've been able to reach anyone by phone, and Padma was worried that Dev might be coming down with the flu. How can someone even catch the flu right now?"
"They're not in Newark,"
Haywan asked.
"No, they went to the shore with Padma's sister. Just for a few days. The kids love the shore."
"Farid should have been with them,"
Betty added.
"But Baxter insisted he stay and work."
"Baxter?" I asked. Everyone turned to look toward the kitchen doors, except Farid, who looked toward the ceiling.
"The boss," Farid said. "He's still upstairs. He hasn't come down for his brekkie and coffee yet. He'll appear once he smells food cooking."
"He's a right bastard," someone muttered.
"Then why do you come here?"
Haywan asked.
"Sharing food makes it easier. And Farid was able to convince Baxter to participate, mostly by pointing out that he could enjoy the food as well without having to risk anything besides letting us inside."
Baxter lured Fareed here by telling him he wanted to retire and was looking for someone who would want to buy to Stinky Pete, the bald man said. Most of us had stopped coming here because Baxter's such a bum. But when he brought Fareed in and we tasted the food, well, we couldn't stay away.
Of course, Baxter hasn't retired yet,
Betty said as something thumped upstairs.
I'm quite certain he's holding on to the place out of spite.
We keep hoping one of the dinosaurs will eat him, but he never steps outside, so that doesn't seem likely,
Roger sighed.
That's a terrible thing to say,
Betty replied, though she didn't look especially upset at the idea.
But what about you three? Why are you in Newark?
We were stuck on campus,
Becca replied.
And I've had to make do with phone calls to my mum as well, but it's getting harder to get through.
Is that where you're headed, then?
Betty asked.
It is, and my friends agreed to come along. The uni wasn't seeming all that safe anymore, what with the portals opening up in the quad and the army bombing everything.
They did a number on some of the roads around here,
the 30-something in the booth replied.
You probably saw that as you came into town.
That's how we ended up in the castle, I said. Otherwise, we wouldn't have driven into the town.
Well, let me get to work,
Fareed declared as he piled everything into two packs.
I should have something in a bit, and enough left over for our second meal.
I was about to ask about the food situation in the city, but one of the women we had traveled with, a barrel-chested woman with a thick brown braid dressed in mechanics coveralls, suddenly spoke up for the first time.
We saw John,
the woman announced.
We were at the castle. Actually, he appeared twice.
Aye, the bald man agreed. The first time it was just him, but then it was like one of them portals had opened and we could see into the past.
And don't forget the lights,
the barrel-chested woman said.
And the slime.
It was a right proper hauntin', the bald man declared.
Stuff and nonsense,
one of the sisters sniffed.
Someone's just having a bit of a laugh with the equipment.
Oh, really?
The bald man snorted.
And did that ridiculous show they designed for the castle feature slime?
They use slime all the time on those kids' shows,
the 30-something pointed out.
It wouldn't be that hard to do.
You'll have to excuse them,
Betty said to the girls and me.
They've been having this discussion for weeks, and they still insist on having it every morning.
You mentioned that John's been more active since the dinosaurs appeared, I replied. Has everyone here seen the ghosts?
We have,
Roger noted, as we found seats on the bar stools.
But some of us are a bit more realistic about what's happening at the castle.
There's a flaming velociraptor in your garden, and yet you can't accept that King John is back as well,
the bald man retorted.
I doubt the velociraptor came back from the dead,
Roger noted.
I'm sure it was alive and well before it stepped through the portal that brought it here. King John, on the other hand, is well and dead and will stay that way.
I hadn't even thought about that,
Becca mused.
What happens if these portals start opening in different eras? I mean, they're already pulling in dinosaurs from different periods, but what if it brings cavemen or such through?
There you go,
Betty chuckled.
One of these portals could open up right in front of King John while he's sitting on his throne, and he could decide to walk through.
That's different, Roger pointed out. Then he would still be alive. And if that happens, then I imagine the ghost would disappear because John would no longer be dead.
Then you admit there's a ghost, someone else replied.
It's no such thing, Roger huffed. It's all smoke and mirrors.
We did see something, I mused. It was well done, whatever it was.
Had to be a ghost, the bald man insisted.
Well, if you'll excuse me,
Betty said as she walked toward the door to the kitchen.
But I've heard all this before, so I'm just going to step out and use the facilities.
The crowd quickly lost itself in the debate, and I was tempted to slip away as well at that point. I looked at my two companions and saw that the two girls were following the discussion with interest. Fareed slipped from the kitchen for a few moments and retrieved something from behind the bar, and I saw him shake his head as he listened to the regulars. I stood up quietly as the Indian cook returned to the kitchen and walked to the back of the pub. Becca and Haywan both looked in my direction, but I only gave them a shake of the head before I slipped through the door into the kitchen. The front of the pub may have been dingy and dark, but the kitchen was pristine and brightly lit. Fareed already had a pot on the stove that gave off a divine aroma while he stood nearby and chopped up the carrots. He looked up in surprise when he heard someone else enter the kitchen and then gave me a questioning glance.
Just wanted to see if you needed a hand, I said.
All is well, Fareed assured me. But I wouldn't mind the company.
Fareed pointed to a stool tucked into a corner near an old landline phone, and I sat down to watch him chop vegetables for a moment. Betty mentioned that you've been combining food supplies to make sure everyone has enough, I noted. Are you running low around here? Fareed focused on his chopping for a moment, and when that was done, he dropped the carrots into the pot. He stirred, added some sort of dried herbs, and then sniffed the steam coming from the pot. Satisfied, he pulled out a second pot, which he filled with water, and set on the stove before he finally turned toward me.
"It's becoming harder to find supplies," Fareed said quickly. "A few people have small gardens or know someone with a garden. Kayla has some chickens that she now has to keep in the house. Others have raided the Toscos for whatever canned goods they can carry. But I don't know how much longer we'll be able to carry on that way."
"The supply lines aren't running," I noted, "and I haven't heard anything about when they might start up again."
"We haven't had any outside news in, well, ages," Fareed confided. "The last phone call with my wife was cut off before she could tell me much more than Dev may have the flu. Baxter was in touch with a friend in Leeds up until 2 or 3 days ago, but he hasn't been able to reach him since."
"What about water?" I asked.
"The taps are still flowing, though the pressure's gone down," Fareed replied. "There's a well near here at a brewery. I've used that a few times."
"Well, what will you do when you can't keep doing this?" I asked.
"I don't know," Fareed sighed. "I suppose I should try to reach my family, but I'm not as brave as you and your friends, and I don't have any weapons. I wouldn't know what to do with them even if I did. But I don't want to die here either."
"It's a hard choice," I noted. "We stayed on the campus over a week before we finally decided we had to leave, and it took a few portals opening right in front of us and a lot of battles with dinosaurs before we finally made our decision. And it's been a tough haul so far. We left Cambridge days ago, and this is as far as we've made it."
"And where are you heading?"
Fareed asked. "To Yorkshire," I said. "Someplace called Ravenscar." Fareed shrugged, which seemed to mean that he hadn't heard of the place. He turned his attention back to the pot for a moment before he looked at me again.
"They've shut off water and power to the other parts of Newark already," the Indian said. "I don't know how much longer the rest of us will be able to hold out."
"We spent time at the power station in Peterborough," I replied. "There's an army contingent there, and while I know they'll stay as long as they can, I also know their leader was worried about how much longer they could stay. Once they leave, I imagine it won't take long before the power goes off completely."
"It doesn't surprise me," Fareed replied. "I'm not at all sure what anyone can do about this."
I was tempted to tell him what Walston had said in his letter about CERN and someone altering dinosaur DNA, but I wasn't sure how to explain how I'd learned about it. While I tried to think of a suitable way to raise the subject, I heard the sound of stairs creaking, and a moment later a door at the far end of the kitchen banged open. A surly-looking man with a cauliflower nose and a perpetual squint barged through and sniffed the air.
"The natives turned up with their offerings, did they?"
the man snickered.
We had some good finds this morning," Fareed replied calmly.
"Who's this?"
the man deadpanned.
"Did you order some kitchen help? Oh, but he's got a gun, this one has. Is he going to want meat for us?"
"I'm just passing through," I replied.
This is Baxter Dunleavy," Fareed said. "He's the owner of Stinky Pete."
"What's left of it," Baxter replied. "Damn near dead with all these dinosaurs running around. You for hire or something?"
Just passing through," I said again. "We ran into some of your neighbors this morning and threw in some supplies for the feast."
"Oh?"
Baxter sneered until Fareed held up the bottle of wine.
"I was going to use it in a sauce," Fareed said.
"That would be a waste,"
Baxter replied as he snatched the bottle from Fareed.
"Decent bit of plonk, this is. It'll earn you a spot at the table."
"Thanks," I mumbled.
"When's the food gonna be done?"
Baxter demanded.
"It will be a bit longer," Fareed replied.
"Well, I've got some work to do then," Baxter said. "Just give me a ring when it's ready."
Baxter pushed back through the door with the wine bottle in his hand. Fareed shook his head and stirred the pot one more time while Baxter's heavy tread slowly faded. "What work?" I finally asked. "And where is he going with that wine?" Fareed shrugged and glanced toward the door.
"He goes down to the basement," Fareed said. "He set up an office there that he keeps locked. I don't know what he does down there, and I don't want to know."
"He seems like an asshole," I remarked. He just took that wine from you and that was it. No thanks or anything.
He's not the easiest man to work for, Fareed agreed. But he isn't here that much, so I put up with him.
I wouldn't let him just take supplies like that, I replied. That bottle was for everyone.
He's the boss, Fareed sighed. And the bottle would have been nice, but it wasn't essential.
Still, I protested. Does he do that kind of thing all the time?
He's the boss, Fareed reiterated.
Fareed grabbed a garlic bulb from a bin and peeled a couple of cloves. He removed the skin and started to dice the garlic, but then he stopped and started to chuckle. A moment later, he laughed loudly, and I joined in, though I wasn't sure why Fareed was laughing.
He's the biggest asshole there ever was or ever will be,
Fareed finally gasped out.
And he's only alive because the dinosaurs know he would taste terrible.
Not after he's done drinking that bottle, I said with a grin. He'd be the perfect meal after he marinated long enough in his office. We laughed again, and a moment later, Becca stuck her head around the door.
What are you two doing back here?
The blonde asked.
Roger's halfway convinced you're poisoning today's food.
No poisoning going on in here, Becca, I said. Though I just met Baxter. We were just exchanging our reviews of his poisonous but juicy character. Fareed snickered and went back to his chopping.
Well, it smells good, even if it is poison,
Becca replied.
Actually, we've had some requests for that wine.
Sadly, Baxter found the wine and took it with him. I'm afraid we won't be able to drink it or enjoy the sauce that Fareed was going to make with it.
Wow. I'm sorry, Fareed,
Becca said with a sad smile.
Seems Baxter's a very poisonous man indeed. Well, whatever you're making smells delicious already.
It will be some time before it is ready, Fareed remarked with a smile. You can play darts or snooker if you want, or there are old novels under the bar if you like reading.
Oh, listening to the stories of King John's return have been entertaining enough,
Becca said as she walked into the kitchen.
Have you seen him?
Fareed shook his head and cast a wary glance toward the door where Baxter had disappeared. Do you think it's really a ghost? I asked.
I don't know what to think, Fareed conceded. But Baxter was happy when it arrived, so it must be evil.
Becca raised an eyebrow and looked at me. I was about to ask another question when the door opened again, and Heiwan stepped into the kitchen.
I had to come see what you were doing. It can't be that hard to fetch a bottle of wine.
Baxter took the wine, and Fareed was just telling us what he thought about King John.
He took the wine. But why?
Because he's an asshole, I replied. On cue, we heard steps on the back staircase again, and then the door swung open. Baxter strolled into the kitchen and went straight for a box of snack foods. He pawed through the contents, and then he grabbed a package of gummy bears.
Are we out of Jaffa cakes? Baxter demanded, as he finally spun around.
Well, if there aren't any in the box,
Fareed said quietly. But Baxter wasn't listening to his cook. He'd spotted Becca and Heiwan, and a sly look crept over his face.
Oh, do you come with the wine? He asked in a poor impersonation of someone much younger and hipper.
No.
Both girls responded at the same time. These are my girlfriends, I added. Becca and Heiwan.
Girlfriends? Are people still saying that in this world? I mean, really, does it matter? You can sleep with anyone now.
And we choose to sleep with Jason,
Heiwan said firmly as she linked an arm with mine.
What you need is someone who can give you a safe place to stay and enough food to get you through.
And you have that,
Becca laughed. Baxter glared at the blonde, but the look slowly turned into a leer as he studied her breasts.
Well, I'll have my ways, he said.
But it sounds like you're running out, I said, as I nodded to Fareed. The Indian ducked his head and took another sniff of the carrots.
Don't believe everything you hear, Baxter said with a scowl. And don't think this is the only thing I've got going.
Fareed looked surprised by that, and he looked over at his boss in confusion. Baxter seemed to realize that he'd said too much as he took in our stares. He muttered something under his breath that I couldn't understand, and then stomped back toward the door. We heard his footsteps on the stairs, and then a moment later, another door slammed shut.
What other business could there possibly be?
Heiwan asked.
I don't know, Fareed said in confusion. He never leaves the basement, and you've met the crowd who still come here.
Maybe he's good friends with John,
Becca joked. The girls laughed, and Fareed joined in a moment later. I smiled, but Becca's comment had me thinking about Baxter, John, and a basement office. So, Farid, do you stay here now? I asked.
Yes, Farid sighed. It's safer than trying to go back to my house every night, and I've removed all the food and supplies from it.
But you've never been to Baxter's basement office?
It's not much, Farid replied. I've been in when I needed his signature for a delivery or such. It's not very big. It's just his desk and his computers.
Computers, I said.
Yes, he likes to spend time online, the cook said.
Huh, I grunted. So, have you been in since the dinosaurs appeared? Farid thought about it for a few moments and then shook his head.
No, he conceded. He keeps the door locked now.
My own mind was whirling as I considered the possibilities, and I saw Farid cast a suspicious glance toward the back door. The girls did as well, and I knew we were all having the same doubts.
Well, we left our gear at the castle. We should probably reclaim it before any more dinosaurs come along.
Or King John makes an encore appearance,
Becca noted.
You're going outside when you don't have to?
Farid asked in surprise. It won't take long, I assured him. Becca gave him a sunny smile and a thumbs up as the three of us slipped back into the front of the pub. We drew a few curious stares from the others as we passed the bar, but we smiled and waved, and then we stepped back into the alley.
Be back in a jiff, I said as I closed the door.
We walked quickly to the road and then stopped in the shadows at the corner. I studied the street, and after I looked back to make sure no one was behind us, I finally spoke.
Did you two learn anything interesting while you were with the local scavengers? I asked.
Some of the people have been having problems with their taps, and there haven't been any deliveries for anything for some time.
Farid said they're running out of food, and he mentioned that the water and power has been shut off in some areas. I don't think there's much food or water left in the town.
But where could it all be? There must be something left in a town this size.
People have been hoarding what they could find all across the country, but it still seems more dire here than I would have thought. If we stayed in Cambridge, we probably would have still been able to find packaged meals and such.
Lots of noodles. There's always lots of noodles left. We saw that in the grocery store.
People don't think about taking that stuff, because they have to boil water, and they're worried they won't have clean water.
So someone's taken all the noodles. This sounds like something from one of the kiddie cartoons. What's that one, Paw Patrol?
Yeah, but this one could end really badly for a lot of people. So, what'd you guys think of Baxter?
He's an asshole with a capital A,
Becca snorted.
And we all agree that he's up to something very bad. Maybe something that explains where all the food has gone.
I nodded and looked toward the castle. I could just make out one of the towers over the neighboring buildings, and I wondered who had put together the laser show. I knew it had gone in before the dinosaurs had attacked, but it seemed a step up from the usual museum show. But who around here could even pull something like that off?
What are you thinking?
Becca asked.
There's something odd going on around here, I said. And I don't just mean the miraculous appearance of King John. I think there's something going on at the castle. And think about it. If you were hoarding supplies, where would you keep them?
Someplace no one ever goes,
Heywan replied.
Oh,
Becca said as she looked toward the castle.
And no one goes near the castle these days. Not since King John started scaring everyone away.
Exactly, I said with a grin.
So, we are going to help these people find the storage and get their supplies back?
I looked at Becca, who huffed and shook her head.
You were the one who wanted to make it to Scampton before the end of the day,
Becca pointed out with a note of satisfaction.
Just one more day, I said. Besides, we can't pass up whatever Farid is cooking. It smells too delicious.
Becca bit her lip and finally sighed.
You're right. We can't let someone as obnoxious as Baxter ruin these people's lives. They're all so nice. We've even had two different offers for rooms for the night if we stayed on.
Beats staying in the castle again, I chuckled. We finally left the shadows and made our way back to the castle grounds.
The large collection of dino bodies was readily visible just inside the gate, and there was an earthy funk in the air which had to come from the corpses. It looked exactly like it had when we had left, but among all the rubble and bodies, it was hard to be sure.
Let's check on the motorbikes, I said. If someone has been stealing stuff around here, I want to make sure that they haven't taken anything of ours.
We stepped inside the ruins and made our way between the corpses to the spot where we had stashed the motorbikes. At first glance, everything looked okay.
The packs were still lashed onto the back, and the gear was still stowed inside. The side carriers on the police bikes were latched, and there weren't any nearby footsteps other than our own. But as I stood next to my motorbike, I noticed that some of my clothing was sticking out from beneath the flap. It wasn't a big deal, and it was perfectly possible that I'd done it myself that morning, but my clothes were all near the bottom of the pile, and I was pretty sure I hadn't somehow left something on top when I'd stowed the gear. "Check your packs," I said. "Does it look like someone's been through them?" I opened my own pack as I spoke, and I found that someone had indeed picked through my gear. I checked the supplies, but it didn't appear that anything was missing. Well, maybe a box of the heavy-duty matches we'd picked up in the camping store, but that was it.
"Someone has looked through mine,"
Heiwan replied.
"One of the fuel canisters is missing."
"Same here,"
Becca said.
"Someone took a t-shirt."
So nothing we would notice right away, but stuff that someone would find useful. They didn't want to take the chance that we might stay and try to find our missing gear, so they didn't take any of the good stuff, like the stove or the tent.
Creepy bastard.
Except he was at the pub the whole time. So someone else must be working with him.
"Maybe it was the ghost,"
Becca suggested. I couldn't tell if the Brit was kidding, and a quick glance at her face showed me she wasn't sure herself. "I would agree King John is mixed up in this somehow," I agreed. "And I'd like to know how."
"My poor mum,"
Becca sighed. "Just think of all the fantastic stories you'll be able to tell her," I replied.
"At this rate, she'll be a doddering spinster before I can regale her with our adventures,"
the blonde chuckled. "Just a day, okay?" I said. "If we haven't solved it by then, we'll pass along what we've learned and then we'll leave."
"It'll be fun,"
Heiwan added.
"Just like a mystery novel." "I hate mystery novels."
"Oh, come on, you're English. You love mystery novels, admit it." Becca sniffed, but I knew I was right when her pretty lips pulled up into a grin.
"Remind me again why we love you so much."
"Because I take care of you. In every way."
"He does do that,"
Heiwan agreed. "Besides, do you really want to leave these people at the mercy of some evil villain?" I asked.
"But what if it really is a ghost?"
Becca asked with a backwards glance toward the battlements. "We assure John he was a memorable king, and then we leave," I said.
"Where do we start?"
Heiwan asked as she looked around the courtyard. "In the guard tower," I suggested. "That's where we heard those noises last night."
"I have a feeling it won't matter where we go,"
Becca replied.
"I think John will find us no matter what."